You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week we are chatting with Brian Sims, who was in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives and also the first openly gay elected state legislatress in Pennsylvania herstory. Of course, we do talk about politics a bit, but because I'm a gay journalist, I also talk about his recent thirst traps and what's going on in the BTS of Brian's life. He is currently the CEO of Agenda Pack, which is helping us get those motherfucking anti-gay bigots out of office. It's a delicious interview, so please enjoy Brian Sims.
Brian Sims is on That's a Gay Ass Goddamn Podcast, calling from the coast of Greece. Brian, what's your favorite Mamma Mia song?
I am not going to give you my favorite Mamma Mia song, in part because I am in the, I'm in like the backdrop of Mamma Mia world, and everywhere I go, everybody is humming or singing Mamma Mia, everywhere. If I was probably doing it coming in to, while I was sitting in the waiting room, I'm sure I was doing it as well. So I'm not going to feed into the Mamma Mia hype here in Greece.
So you agree that when you go to Greece, it turns you into a homosexual who has to sing ABBA, and that's on period.
That seems official now.
Brian, there's so much of your life that I want to talk about. Obviously, the politiques, obviously, the recent mariage, but most importantly is that you are also a twin brother, much like myself. Brian, do you have a twin that is gay or straight?
I have a twin that is straight, and very straight. And in all the straight ways, he is very straight. What about you?
Like truly identical, well, fraternal, but also identical situations, which is that my twin brother is very straight, but also looks nothing like me. Yours is the same?
Looks nothing like me. I spent most of my life really wishing I looked a lot like, more like my twin brother. Now that I'm a sort of fully formed adult, I'm fine in my own skin and happy with who I am. But my, you know, being a teenager in the 90s, my twin brother was a 4-sport athlete with, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes. And he was good at school and he's a wonderful guy. He's got a great personality. All the, you know, easy to hate, but completely unhateable.
Wow, that's really a gag, because you were also an athlete, but it's funny that even a athlete like yourself was still comparing yourself to someone else. When you eventually came out to your straight athlete twin brother, what was his reaction? Was he someone who had known many a gay and it wasn't a thing, or was it sort of a took him some time to get used to?
I actually think it was neither of those things. To be honest with you, I don't think, you know, I came out to my brother when we were 22 years old, right as we were wrapping up college. And I don't think he had any other gay friends or anybody out to him in his life at the time. And he handled it with a degree of sort of bro-y grace that I wish on a lot of people. He didn't step outside of his regular demeanor and behave like a fully different person. He found a way for this to fit very comfortably in the relationship that we had and make it, you know, sort of extend it, maybe increase it, but it didn't become this amorphous different thing that was a distraction. It sort of just became a part of our relationship.
I love that so much. I think it's always interesting when queer people come out to their straight family members and
to especially straight family members who don't know many gays, because my twin, we were seniors in high school when I came out to him, and I still remember we were in a car at a gas station.
Picked the right moment, did you?
Yeah, I was like, this is perfect. Unleaded, amazing. So I told him what I told everybody when I first came out. And again, I'm 18. So like, it sounds sad, but it was the truth. I told my twin brother, I was like, I don't want to be gay, but I am. And I'm learning to be okay with that. And his response to me, which I don't fault him, it was just sort of a sign of the time, is he said, well, wait a minute, if you don't want to be gay, then you're not. And I had to be like, sweetie.
Yeah, if only it worked that way.
That's if it's not how I certainly have tried. I mean, every time I kissed my one girlfriend I had, I pictured Jude Law in The Holiday.
In fairness, so did Jude Law in The Holiday. I think one of the things with my twin brother is that he probably had figured out something about me that I had figured out about me that I didn't know at the time how to articulate. And that is that I knew I wasn't straight long before I knew I was gay. I knew what straight looked like. I knew what straight felt like. I saw straight everywhere. And that wasn't me. Now, gay is a different thing. Gay is just not the absence of straight. It's not the antithesis of straight. Gay is a different thing. It's what we're doing. But I didn't know that. And so in the absence of straight, I didn't know any better.
That's such a great point. I think we're told that straight is what you should be. But then if you don't see yourself in that, we have to do the exploration ourselves to see, okay, well, actually, where do I belong and what actually am I? But speaking of what am I and how did I get here?
That's what my so-called life was for.
Exactly, Brian. And that's why I'm going to ask you the famous podcast question, which is, Brian Sims, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Hollywood, to some extent. And thank you, Hollywood. Do you remember the Neverending Story?
Absolutely. That giant fucking fluffy flying...
big fluffy dog. That was not my first crush. Atreyu, who got to ride that dog, was my first crush. Atreyu from the Neverending Story made me gay. The world's falling apart. Not enough good stories are being told. And where does the world turn to? To Atreyu. And so I turned to Atreyu too.
There's two things I think is beautiful about this answer. Number one is that magic is gay. I think that
very gay.
Roald Dahl was my Bible, a big friendly giant, a bunch of witches. And I think that the Neverending Story was obviously catapulting you to a different world. And tell me this, were you hoping to go on the ride with Atreyu? Were you wanting to comb Atreyu's hair? What do you think was your entree into wanting Atreyu?
Yeah, the long hair. I will say this. I love the adventure part of it. He had a horse for most of the movie, Artax, who dies in the Swamp of Sadness. It's terribly sad. If you haven't revisited it, do. I liked the confidence. I liked the adventure of it all. This was an adventure that had a problem that had no solution, an adventure that seemingly had no end. And they, you know, nobody knew what to do. And they found this person that was clearly the right person. And he had the confidence to sort of not knowing the answer or knowing the solution, trust that others saw that in him and set out to do it. Yeah, man, that's probably a lot more of an analysis than at the time I was thinking. Cool dog horse, cool actual horse. You're cute. And you're going on an adventure. I'm in.
Yeah, you said tens, tens, tens across the board. It's the way that you describe it makes you sound, and I say this with deep respect, but you sound like a nerd. Would you say that you are a nerd trapped in a jock's body?
You know, it's funny. The jock thing didn't happen to me until much later in life. And I'm grateful for the nerddom much earlier in life. It helped me find, being a nerd is sort of like being a polyglot. It means you've had to listen and pay attention to a lot of other communities or communication styles and find the ones that are right for you, if ever. And I think that was a lot more useful. Being a jock can be incredibly exclusive in ways that are the opposite of trying to integrate, the opposite of trying to make friends and be friends and all of those things. And so, being really good at school was something that helped save me from being picked on in school. And for me, it was Star Trek was where my nerddom lived. And being a Next Generation kid was what I thought was happening in America at the time. There's this concept in Star Trek where planets or civilizations aren't allowed to gain entry into this sort of interplanetary body until they've reached intergalactic travel, and that can really only happen after a time of peace. Now, the whole show is based on that really not being true, but largely this concept of is that peace is the impetus for the type of technology that it takes to leave your planet and explore space. And I thought that was the direction we were going when I was a kid in like the 80s and 90s. It felt like a technological, peaceful future was a part of our mantra.
Oh, Brian, if only we were living in an era of peace. But so much of what you said actually strikes me. I think that one of the gifts that you were given of being born nerd is that you were forced to like develop, or you were encouraged even to develop your own personality point of view. Because I feel like, I'm going to generalize here, but like if you are born jock, and you're born in the 1% of physical ability, I feel like a lot of those people then as adults are bad in bed and awful to talk to.
I mean, they're lost also. Not for nothing, but every one of us knows somebody that thought they were supposed to be a thing that they are not or no longer. And those people are generally incredibly lost.
Yeah.
And I was never going to be one of those people. I get asked often if leaving politics was really hard for me, because I think people often think politics, being in politics, was a lifelong dream, which it was not. And so I don't know. Growing up a nerd, there's another component to this, and this, and I'm an Army brat. My mom and dad are both retired lieutenant colonels in the Army. And so I was the new kid in every school I was ever in, always. Every 2 to 3 years, I was new in school, except for from ages 9th through 12th grade, what I got to do all at one school in Pennsylvania. But I was 200 pounds going into 8th grade and brand new. I was just always the new fat kid in school. And in many ways, it helped me find the best people ever. Also, it's how we, you know, everybody knew that really, really weird girl in school that was like easy to come out to. Thank you to whom all that weird girl probably loves this podcast. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being that person that I could saddle up next to and say, hey, I need to tell you something that I can't tell anybody else.
Any chance we have to shout out the girlies that sat next to us at lunch, who let us braid their hair, who let us talk about the pop girlies we wanted to sing with. We always salute them and thank them for their cervix. And we just are very, very grateful. But I do think it's interesting that for you, having moved to all these different states, my research tells me you live in 17 states before landing in Pennsylvania. Were you then... Obviously, like you're acclimating to a new social environment every time you start in a new school. Do you think this either delayed or expedited or did anything to your coming out journey? Because what I'm really getting to is, was your first boy-boy kiss while you were in high school, or did you wait till getting out into college?
It was early. I first kissed a boy at 15.
What? Brian?
I got to kiss the same boy for a while from 15 till around 17, and even then a couple of times afterward.
I'm so fucking jealous. I didn't have my first kiss till I was in college. Wait, give us the behind the scenes here.
There's only a couple of details that I can actually share, because this is someone that's still sort of around family and someone that people know. When I had this, like a lot of gay kids, I thought I had the best girlfriend ever of all time, from like 15, 16, 17. But I also, at the time, like I said, I knew I wasn't straight, and there was a particular guy in my life that was my exact age to a T, that was friends with, you know, my family, and was just somebody that we knew, lived in the neighborhood. And I don't remember the moment of our first kiss. I actually legitimately don't, but it was probably around 15 or 16 years old, which, hurrah.
Hoorah, indeed. I was very far away from putting myself out there in that way. I think it's partly the universe was probably like giving you this friendship because it knew you were ready to have your first kiss, and then allow those years of experimentation. And maybe the universe for me was like, no, it's gonna better serve you when you're 19 and a freshman at NYU. And I had to wait.
19's not all that late.
No. Right?
And I think a lot about my straight friends. My college teammates, my high school football teammates are all still largely my best friends. Hmm. And I know many of them didn't have their first serious relationship until late in college. You know, I bet the, I, this idea that all athletes are womanizers or are really good with, you know, women on campus was just ridiculous. My buddies were some of the more awkward, more ridiculous people that I knew, is whether they're my best friends, but also weren't dating anybody.
That's interesting to me, because it is a stereotype about college athletes specifically. I mean, you were the co-captain of the Bloomsburg University football team. I'm told you were the first openly gay captain in the history of the NCAA. Were any
openly, right?
Openly gay, openly
there's,
gay.
There's just no chance there weren't a lot of gay football captains somewhere.
Hot. So then what was your, if you were kind of part of like the goofy gang, we'll say, of the college athletes, can you at least tell me that you had some guys throwing themselves at you in college and you got to really lap in the luxury of that?
Not my teammates.
But other students.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. Keep in mind, this was largely right around the time the internet was happening. So there wasn't gay.com existed, AOL, the M4M rooms, that kind of thing, the chat rooms, those existed at the time, but there wasn't, I didn't have, obviously this was pre-Facebook or anything, MySpace, nothing like that. And so it wasn't easy. There wasn't an LGBTQ group or a GSA at my college. I think there was this idea of like, when you met somebody, make it work because you might not meet somebody else.
Gotcha.
And I realized really quickly that kind of wasn't the case. And, I wasn't out until I was a senior in college, I think that my college's queer community probably knew that I was queer. What I'm grateful for is that there didn't seem to be any resentment. I didn't have to worry about backlash. I'm a civil rights attorney. I care deeply about other people's lives and values and how they're treated and approached. And I always have. And I'd like to think at those times when there was an opportunity in my college town for somebody to have outed me, which there probably were a number of those times, that those people evaluated me and my behavior and who I was and what I was doing and decided not to.
I think what's beautiful about that story is that people saw that your energy was coming from a place of kindness and of activism. And I think that that probably led to people not like wanting to either pile on or gay bash or whatever will be. And I think that it's so cool how you've integrated that part of your personality into your work, because sure, the politics of it all is a gigantic part of your story, but also the recent AIDS life cycle journey you've been on is unbelievable. And I think that it would be insane if I do not talk about the headline news, which is that you literally had surgery days ago based on what happened during the AIDS life cycle. Give us, first of all, how are you feeling? Are you okay?
No, it hurts like hell.
Ugh.
It hurts like hell. I've got a metal rod in there now holding it kind of all together. So it's a lot better than it was in the days right after. My husband founded an AIDS life cycle team 4 years ago. And I've been the co-captain of it now for the last 2 years, called the Lavender Scare. And for those that don't know, the AIDS life cycle has been this ride for the last three decades, a bike ride that goes from San Francisco to LA. It's 545 miles. Thousands of riders participate in it. And this year was the last year of the ride in the form that it is in now. And we had 14 people on our team. We raised over $100,000. And it starts on a Sunday. And on Saturday, you have to go drop off your bike and your gear. And a mile out from the drop-off spot, I got my bike stuck in a trolley track groove that went across the bike trail. And it toppled me. And I broke my clavicle. I broke some ribs.
Oh, and,
really? I broke my ribs with my own elbow, which seems really unfair. Spent some time in the emergency room with an ER doc that was a trans woman, former Air Force officer, and one of the coolest badasses I'd been around in a very long time.
Wow.
But we got discharged, and we caught up to the ride just south of San Francisco around San Jose the next day. And my husband finished the ride with our team. A lot of my gear finished on my team. And my bike even finished the ride. There was a rider on day three or four whose bike crapped out on him, and we fitted him to my bike. So even my bike finished.
What really genuinely touched me about the way that you were posting about it is I think a lot of people would take the injury as like an excuse to wallow and be like, fuck the world, I'm getting the fuck out of here. And you took it as just like a plot point that just changed the trajectory of that experience, because I think that the positivity was probably influenced by like your team, the Lavender Scare, and by the mission as a whole. Is that sort of
about it?
Yeah.
No problem. I'm a man of a certain age. I'm 46 years old. My inclination when I'm hurt is to haul up alone and be pissed off at the world and make bad decisions about myself and other people. I know how I would normally handle something like this, but I had two things working against that. One is I could not sleep horizontally for a week after the injury. Or I would re-injure myself. So if I had to sleep sitting up, it meant that being at a hotel wouldn't matter. It also meant I couldn't fly back to the East Coast and have surgery immediately because I was stuck on the West Coast. And so I made the decision to drive along with the team, you know, about 100 miles a day and be with them each night and at the campsites and all of that. And I kind of decided very early on that if I was going to do that, I was going to borrow everyone's good energy. It sounds hokey. It sounds way cheesier than I actually am. But I just kind of decided that if, you know, the last one of these, this ride was way too important for lots of reasons, and people break their clavicles all the time. It's how really serious cyclists like look at each other. It's how they like introduce themselves. And so it would have seemed really dramatically wasteful to take something that's really common and to ruin an otherwise really uncommon experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a lot worse things could happen than you every night joining up with a group of queer people kikiing as they take off their lycra and blow off some steam.
Climb out of cycling gear.
I'm like, yeah, that's not the worst alternative to dealing with an injury. The AIDS life cycle, I actually interviewed Tracy Gilchrist of Holding Space fame, and this was years ago, and she actually was really talking up the AIDS life cycle, and I think it's just like it seems like such an incredible thing. But can you tell me like why was this past year the last year?
Yeah, for lots of complicated and complex reasons, I'm sure that I don't know about, but mostly from what it looks like from an outsider's perspective is that this ride benefits the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and the LA LGBTQ Center, both among the premier organizations in the country that serve the communities that they serve and do the work that they do. They are very differently sized organizations. And for the bulk of the AIDS life cycle, they have together created the leadership of the AIDS life cycle, which almost stood as its own organization. And you know, there was a leader at the AIDS life cycle and a staff and team dedicated year round to the AIDS life cycle. But that's a really complicated thing for two other non-profit public interest organizations, especially public health organizations, to be managing partially remotely, partially in person. And so the decision was made and was announced during the ride as well, that each of these organizations is going to take a component of the AIDS life cycle home. And next year, we're going to see three-day rides in Northern California and in Southern California
that
continue to benefit these organizations. I think just what won't be there is the sort of administrative behemoth of this large-scale organization that they're both trying to maintain.
So it's basically still obviously fighting for the cause, but it's just going to look a little different than it has. And I think I'm glad you said that, because of course part of me is like in a fragile emotional state most of these days. So I'm like, oh God, is our community losing
it? What went wrong?
But it's been really, really cool to see how you and your new husband have really made this such a big part of your union. And I am going to talk about the relish, but I do think that part of what I've enjoyed from watching your AIDS life cycle stuff is the way that you talk about it on social media. And your social media is pretty delicious. Obviously, there are thirst traps, but you also gave us a great look into your time seeing Oh Mary with Titus Burgess. And I just need to bring this up because my husband is in New York right now, and he, I think, is going to see Titus tonight. So tell me, are you a Broadway queen, or was this a one-off?
No, I'm certainly becoming much more of a Broadway queen. We moved to Hell's Kitchen about a year and a half ago, and I'm there right in the middle of everything. And
yeah,
you know, there's things like getting to see Titanic very early on before everybody else was getting to see it. That felt like such a gift. Seeing Cole in the role originally was something that at the time felt really fantastical. It felt something really amazing, something that I would be talking about. When we went and saw Titus in the role, I was having a hard time explaining to people afterward how this character I just told you was the best it could ever be could possibly be better, and better is not the right word to use. It's different. It's the role of Mary sung for the back of the seats, for the back row in a different way. We're big Jinx fans in our household. And so, you know, we've already gotten our tickets. We'll be seeing Jinx as well in August. My whole time in Hell's Kitchen, I might just be seeing reoccurring Oh Mary Lee.
Well, and God bless, because I have this idea for the podcast we have on Substack, bonus episodes that are a little dirtier, hornier, to keep the respect on the main feed. But there's also a chat feature that I'm trying to figure out ways to use. And one of the ways that I want to use it is by brainstorming all the different Marys that we need. And obviously, Titus, I am dying to see. Jinx, I get chills thinking about her taking over the role. But I also think that we're in a really exciting position to hopefully see Oh Mary run as long as it can and continue to put in iconic people. Like, is there anybody that you would just be soaking wet over seeing take over after Jinx?
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Who would I love to take over the role of Mary after Jinx? I think I would really like to see it be in the same. Oh, are you guys hearing Greek music riding
tiny
by
bit,
in the background
but it's,
as well?
It's a beautiful It's a beautiful ambiance.
We're not supposed to speak about her until later, but for me it'd be Stockard Channing. My favorite. I would put Stockard Channing in that role in a heartbeat.
Oh my God, Stockard Channing as Mary is so inspired.
Mary?
Stockard Channing is inspired for many reasons. It's because you're giving us not only the character actress of character actresses, but you're also giving us a woman of a certain age. And I do think that Mary, if we get a... Stockard Channing is 81 years old.
Okay.
And if we get an 81-year-old Mary, I think that's absolutely inspired, because Mary Todd Lincoln is someone who has lived many lives, especially
well,
in this
she
play.
Also, none of them were as a musical twink or as, you know, a tall, proud black man. And so I think the multidimensional nature of Mary deserves an 81-year-old songstress.
I think you're 100% correct. That's such a great answer. And I cannot wait. Maybe we should have a reunion up after you see Jinx, so we can see if you still have a pulse and if you're alive, because I have a feeling that it's going to be absolutely iconic. When you do post on Instagram, either it's about Agenda Pack, it's about AIDS life cycle, but you did post a recent thirst trap that was captioned "Shirts in this economy," and almost 20,000 people liked it. Tell me, Brian, are your thirst traps just something fun to do? Is there are you doing this when you need a pick me up? What's the BTS of you showing us those tits?
Right. As you're asking this question, I'm thinking, no, just whenever I'm feeling like it. But then you get to the second part, I'm thinking, maybe it's whenever I'm feeling insecure. I don't know. No, that picture at the top was something that even my husband, when he got home from work, he was like, mirror selfie? I was like, yeah, I don't know. It just struck me. I was just feeling it. And you probably can tell by going through that. It's a pretty uncommon thing for me. It took me years and years and years and years to get more comfortable in my build and my body and the attention that it detract or distract from the things that I care about, that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And to be able to approach it in a way that's kind of cheeky and kind of funny and to be a little irreverent about it has been a bit hard earned.
Listen, Brian, I think you're landing on something very real. And of course, I'm bringing up the thirst trap just because it's fun to talk to a sexy man about his sexy body. But I think there's also something underneath it, which is that as gay people, there's this like double-edged sword where we're really trying to embrace who we are and take away shame. But then like when I post something like that as well, I have a flood of thoughts of like, how am I being perceived? Is this taking away from, are people thinking that I'm now just trying to be a whole on the internet versus my actual goal of, you know, doing comedy and bringing joy to the world and taking away shame and all those things? And I think that it's like, actually a little more nuanced than we sometimes give it credit for, which is like, I think it's okay for you to, for us to feel proud and good about sometimes posting the things that we just like want to post and not, and try not to overthink it, even though our brains are telling us that we should consider all of the ramifications.
And there is something very smart about being a person that is capable of analyzing a scenario or a situation and making sure that you act in a way that is in your own best interests and reflects your values and who you are. You can also just be a funny hole on the internet sometimes, right? You can contain multitudes. And I think it's reductive, it's silly, and it ultimately can be really harmful to pretend otherwise. But I understand why not everybody feels their sexy best self. That's fine. But it's dangerous to make sure to try to enforce an aesthetic view that doesn't allow others to feel their sexy best self. And that's where I draw the line. I don't need everyone to feel like selfies and shirtless is for them, but I sure as hell want to make sure that nobody's preventing somebody from feeling like their best self.
Exactly. It's like as long as you're not hurting anybody else, or, I mean, it's just like live your fucking bliss. And I've really, my whole journey has been like, and I talk about this a lot in my show, that I had all the shame about body hair. And so as I like got older and then really tried to embrace it, sometimes if I post like a shirtless thing that's like leaning into the hair of it all, it's like in a way I'm like telling the 15-year-old version of myself who thought I was disgusting that it's actually okay. And it's there actually can be, you know, celebratory parts of, again, showing pink hole.
Yeah, I'll tell you that my husband he likes a larger me. He likes a meatier me than I like. And there is something both really comforting in that, and knowing that if I decide a different version, a meatier me is something I like, or if I'm a meatier version of myself, whether I like it or not, that he's still going to like it. Brings me so much comfort and so much joy.
It is. Well, that's amazing too. And let's get into that, because you met your husband at Bear Week in P-Town.
Bear Week.
Were you, did you and do you identify as a bear?
I hope I always am identified by the bear community as a part of the community. It was maybe the single best thing that ever happened to me within the queer community, was being embraced by the bear community. When I was elected at 32, I was a 250-pound, you know, clean shaven, kind of doughy baby faced homosexual. And I really quickly grew a beard before I took office that year. I had about 8 months before I took office. And from the moment I had that beard, it was the very first time in my life I got two things. One was positive, like genuinely what I thought was positive affirmation for how I looked, not just for being like a big athletic guy. It was the first time I ever thought like guys were complimenting whether or not, like, was I handsome? Was I that? And it felt very good. And it was the first time I'd ever been around bears that were like, oh, hey, that one's with us. It wasn't, do you guys like me, or do you like the things about me that I find insecure? It was just, hey, we got you. And, you know, for all of the ways that queer people can be exclusionary and exclusive, when we use all of those same powers for good, we are really fucking good. And bears are among the best at doing that. Bears turn body image issues into sanctity. Bears turn exclusivity into inclusivity. Bear spaces are spaces that have gravity. They're not pushing people away. And I have seen that at every moment that I've ever had the opportunity to be in sort of bear exclusive spaces. And, you know, my husband wasn't, we met in Provincetown, and he wasn't there for Bear Week. He was there for the week before, and I had just gotten there for Bear Week. And we met on the one day, the one overlap day. And the rest is history.
And the rest is herstory.
Is herstory.
Listen, I think it is important to note that, like, there can be a lot of exclusionary practices in any community, but especially, I think, queer people, we since we were sort of pitted against each other growing up. I think there is can be obviously cattiness and all those things, but it's also important to celebrate the really positive parts of the community. And that's what I don't want to be like, what's the word? Like ignorant to the pitfalls of the community, but I also don't want to like wallow in that. And so I think it's important to celebrate communities like the bear community. Like even being in LA, you're told that it's all WeHo monsters. And I really have met like an incredible community of people. And sure, have I met some people who are social climbers? And do I have some defense mechanisms up when it comes to that? Yes, but it's that's why there's such a magic in going someplace like P-Town. And I have this random fantasy that like one day even like my straight brothers, whether it's P-Town or Palm Springs, or I like just to let them be the minority,
it's in the Mecca.
Exactly. It's like that's something that I really I did go to a gay wedding. One of my like lifelong friends was married actually in Boston, and my straight family members were in the minority, and it was so fucking refreshing to be dancing to Robin and then watching them be the odd people out. Oh God, was that good. But since we brought up the meet cute of your man, so let's go there. You're in P-Town. From what I've done in my research, he spotted you. He goes, oh my God, that's Brian Sims. He comes up to you.
Yeah, I didn't know any of that at the time. The guy that represents the Cape and lives in Provincetown, the senator that represents the Cape, is one of my closest friends. His name is Julian Sear. Julian is a delightful ginger bear now in his late 30s. And he was elected, I believe, first in 2016. And I spent a lot of bear weeks on his couches. And that year, this would have been 2020, I was late. We were in session and I was late getting out of the Capitol in Harrisburg to get to Provincetown. It's about an 8-hour drive. And I had to go straight to High Tea in P-Town to find my friend Julian. He wasn't home, and so I couldn't get into his place. For those that know P-Town, High Tea at the end of every day from roughly 4 to 7, every single living thing in Provincetown goes to this one place for drinks, pets, plants, men, women, children, animals, all of it. And I was there by myself looking for my friend Julian, and he found me, he took a drink order for me, and he disappeared. And I'm standing in this giant crowd, which is the most anxiety-inducing situation you can imagine. And the crowd splits down the middle. And at the far end is this handsome guy staring at me. And I did that thing where I wasn't sure if he was looking at me. I was sort of like, you know, and I kind of shifted my body weight a little bit. And it was very clear that he was looking at me. And that moment didn't last very long, but the crowd closed up. And my friend found me, and I was with him for the next hour and a half, and we went to leave. And I was with 6 or 7 people by then, and Alex, my now husband, walked up, and he stopped us all. And he said, hey, I don't want to interrupt you, but I just really want to thank you for everything that you do. And I said, oh, fuck, weren't you that guy that I was checking out earlier? And he punched his friend, and yeah. And he was. And my friends liked the way that he came up and introduced himself so much that they like saw golf clapped him, and they invited him to dinner with us where we were going. And we've pretty much been together ever since.
Oh my God. Am I allowed to say that while that story is incredibly cute, there's also something very hot about it? Is it okay if I say that?
It was pretty hot. It was all very hot.
It's very hot because I think that there's something about the confidence of a go-getter. There's also the like, he has it even with an audience of your friends, he still has the chutzpah to go up to you. And then the fact that he was then asked to dinner. Did you have your first kiss that night or did you wait?
We did not wait.
Good. I mean, it's such a hot meet cute that I'm sure that it was an electric.
Yeah, it was very clear that we wanted to be alone and we weren't. So we went to dinner with everyone. And then we walked over to the Provincetown Brewery. A bunch of the owners are friends. I think Alex was even wearing a Provincetown Brewery hat at the time. We walked over there. We each ordered a drink. I think we toasted, we sipped the drinks, and we were like, so we should get out of here, right? And we set our full drinks down and we got out of there.
This chair is sopping wet. Just a delicious story.
Eric, I had to drop him off in front of all of his housemates the next day. They were checking out because it was the end of their week and the beginning of my week. And so I had to pull up in a car, and there was like 9 guys from Boston all lined up with their bags, and Alex's packed bags for him, like just like this.
I mean, imagine those friends, what they were talking about. They're like, yeah, he has such a crush on Brian, and now he's being dropped off
and
by Brian. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I was cheated by you. This is Mamma Mia 3, bitch. Oh my God. I love a good meet cute. I love a good first kiss story. I love the fact that you are now married and you're planning this. Now, you got married before Trump took office, which was very understandable. And in fact, you were interviewed about this and you said that our marriage is worth fighting for. And we hope all the people that are excited for us and glad for us and congratulate us are also echoing that in their actions and not just their ethics and their morals and their values, but in their actual actions. Our marriage is under attack and who we are is under attack. And so to support, to congratulate us, and to be grateful that we are able to do this comes with the attendant responsibility of respecting it, protecting it, and fighting for it. I think that's incredibly well said. And I think that the question I have for you is, since we're living in this kind of a nightmare time for queer rights, do you have any advice for queer people who maybe have family members or people around them who are not voting in their queer family members' best interests? How do you think we should deal with living in a nightmare time and definitely knowing people who are even ignorantly, unknowingly voting against our rights?
Yeah, this is one of the most complicated questions in any type of advocacy, in any advocate's life. They're always asked, do you bring this same advocacy home? And if you don't, are you being honest to the advocacy? And I think that's a part of the analysis of this question. And I often say to people, advocate where you are safe to do it. Not advocating in places that are unsafe for you both stops you from advocating and might potentially stop you from advocating altogether.
Right.
And in many ways, that is a home space. It is easier for people intellectually, emotionally, sometimes physically, to advocate for equality in places that they are slightly removed from than the places that are their front and backyard. And so the early answer to this question is, I don't want people to feel like they are not being true to their queerness or not being true to their ancestors by not stopping their racist uncle from being a homophobic sack of shit.
Right.
Your job is not your queerness, your ability to speak to our values and help those values proliferate doesn't hinge on whether or not your aunt still votes for Donald Trump. And it can't. And so there's this thing that I think happens where a lot of people feel like, if I can't even convince my mom that my marriage is worth fighting for, why would I be convincing other people? And that is the wrong analysis. Start in the places that you can. Oftentimes it's in work. Sometimes it's just casual conversation, casual friendships. Those things, especially the casual nature of them, can remove the risk of if it goes badly or if it goes wrong. And yet the outcome is the same. If you spend 10 years trying to get your mom to do something, but 10 minutes trying to get somebody else to do the same thing, the thing has still happened. One person has done it. But 10 minutes versus 10 years, you know, you could do a lot with those 10 years.
Damn.
And so I push back.
I love that answer. It's so nuanced because I think you're right that it does not take away from your queerness. And I think that there's a bit of a binary right now in terms of like, either it's black and white, you're for us or against us. But I think that the reason why we're living in such a nightmare time is explained by the fact that there are so many people who are convinced by Trump or feel that they are not doing something wrong by supporting the administration. And I think that the nuance is that, you know, queer people, we are going to come up against people that do not agree with us. But I think that it is doing a disservice to ourselves if the answer is flat out to cut those people out versus figuring out a way to be activists in our, like you said, a way that keeps us safe, but also taking care of ourselves for our safety and for our happiness in any way that we can. And I think that you and your husband, how do you feel about now having gotten married before the Trump administration took over and now planning this wedding? Does it change your perspective on the wedding at all?
Yes, it does. We got married last year at the end. We got married in December, December 21st, strategically in Massachusetts, because it is one of the safest states in America for marriage equality's future. It has 100% ranking on LGBTQ equality, much like California, much like New York. It is one of the states where marriage equality is enshrined in the state constitution. And although all marriages legally live within state law, obviously the Supreme Court has ruled on what marriages can and cannot be. And I believe that this Supreme Court is going to undo Obergefell and is going to, and we're going to lose marriage equality at the federal level. And so for us, it was incredibly important for us to protect our marriage as soon as we could, for it to live in a place that, you know, I believe that Connecticut would fight as, and Massachusetts would fight as hard for our rights as we would fight for our own rights. I do believe that. The wedding itself, you know, we're going to have a lot of people at our wedding, a lot of family. And we've asked ourselves, what about those family that aren't supportive of our politics? And in years past, that's a very different conversation. You know, I can understand why, you know, a family member that was voting Republican maybe in the 90s and 2000s could also be someone. In fact, I have family members like this who have voted Republican in the 90s and 2000s who fully support my rights as a queer person. They can't support this administration because it is a hallmark of this administration to deny those rights. And I do understand intellectually how someone in the past could say, listen, this administration isn't fully coming for you. I care about the finances or whatever, but that we're not in that era anymore. And so we've spoken a lot with each other and with family about what does it mean? Can you be at our celebration while you made it harder for us to celebrate? Can you be at our celebration if ultimately if it goes away and you were one of the people, there was the impetus for that?
Right.
And there's two answers to this. One is no, you can't. And two is if you are going to be, expect to have your eyes opened, maybe your mind changed, but you're going to understand that you are in the moral minority. There are two types of people in this world that seem to oppose equality. The people that just fucking hate us, and the followers and the losers that want to go along with them because they think they're cooler. And the people that fucking hate us, I don't need those people around. I don't need them. But I can sure show those other people why they're wrong.
I want to make sure to ask a couple more questions before we get to the final podcast question. Now, one of those questions is, you, Brian Sims, are in your sewing journey. Are you becoming a trad wife?
Oh, you know what? I can't bake for shit, but I would love to try to make some moccasins. Mm. So maybe I am. I could go ultimate trad wife. I'll go full back like 1700s trad wife.
Yeah, I don't know. Now you're going so trad wife that you're becoming a lesbian.
Making stew. Oh.
Would you say who between the two of you, you and Alex, who's a bigger bridezilla for planning the wedding?
No bridezilla at all between the two of us. I mean that honestly. We're two people that never thought a moment of our lives about what our wedding would look like or how that would reflect upon us. And so we just get to hear all these really great ideas, pick from a couple of them, and we've got this kind of mashup of everybody's great ideas.
Love that. Okay, so final question as a dessert girly, what is either the cake situation, the dessert situation, what are we serving for sweets?
Yeah, so Alex doesn't believe in cake. I told you he's perfect, but there are, you know, perfect with an asterisk, and one of them is that he has really strong feelings about cake. And so while we won't have cake per se at the wedding, there will be... What I'm sort of a charcuterie of desserts, if you will.
Hell yeah.
Some cheesecake, some little cake topper things. I'm an ice cream person. And so there will be, I believe, several different types of ice cream there. I don't generally go chocolate unless there's caramel or peanut butter involved. And so I think some of that's going to happen. But yeah, that's no three-tiered cake with two grooms or anything on it like that. We're more likely to like fight those two grooms than want them on the cake.
Hot. Well, listen, I have also gone on a political rampage against cake because I do like cake, but I think statistically speaking, wedding cakes are usually bad. And I think that you have to fight hard to get a good one. But good wedding cake is great. Good cake is good fucking cake. So one day Alex and I can talk about cake.
You guys can lament cake together on an episode.
And exactly, in all of its forms. Brian, your final podcast question is coming up. And that question is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress. Is it the character actress that we think you would save?
It is. It is First Lady Bartlett. It is Stockard Channing. It is me if I were in drag.
Yeah. Wait, have you ever done drag before?
No, but... tell me I wouldn't look just like Stockard Channing.
You would look like Stockard Channing, and I think that...
Stockard Channing, if you're watching this, if you're listening, and I know that you are a huge fan of Eric and what he does here, if you're watching this, the red dress that you wore at the end of Tu Wong Fu. Thanks for, is that what it is? Tu Wong Fu. Thanks for everything, Julie Newmar. At the very end, the I'm a drag queen. That red dress, let that be my drag queen dress. Do this for me, Stockard, and I will do anything for you.
Okay, you heard it here first, folks. I'm looking at the dress on my Goog, and I can absolutely see you rocking
Ruffles
that.
For days.
Oh my God, Brian. And listen, it would really, you both have the piercing blue eyes. You both have the cuntiness. Strong jaw, the cuntiness factor. Truly, Stockard Channing is a great answer because she not only is such a great actress, but she gave us the film that made so many of us gay, which is Grease. And also, I got to see her on Broadway in Pal Joey. So, Stockard, as you're watching, I want to say thank you for that. That was, you fucking killed it. And, Brian, it is a stunning, stunning answer, as have all of your answers been in this gay-ass interview. Thank you so much for joining me. It has truly been a goddamn pleasure. And I would love for you to tell our stunning listeners where to follow you and if there's anything you'd like to plearg.
First of all, Eric, thank you for having me. I think you're a blast. But you've interviewed a lot of my friends. This was much better than they said it would be. So I'm grateful for that. The place where people can find me is to find the pack that I'm running right now. Agenda Pack uses a lot of information to find the country's most beatable bigots. There are 500,000 elected officials in America, but only about 400 of them come for our rights every day. And only a handful of those are beatable. My organization finds the ones that are beatable, and we put resources behind going directly at them. So look for me at Agenda Pack. I'm on Instagram at Brian Sims PA, not Prince Albert. It's from Pennsylvania. Get asked that every now and again.
Sure.
Maybe it'll be Prince Albert going forward.
One day.
I don't live in Pennsylvania anymore. and if Facebook is still up and running, I'm on Facebook. It's right next to my MySpace page.
Perfect. Right next to your top 8 on MySpace. And also, we're going to be linking Brian's socials. We're going to be linking Agenda Pack, and we're going to fucking defeat the country's most beatable goddamn bigots. We are going
damn
to
right.
rally for the queer community, and we're going to say thank you to Brian Sims. And Brian, let's manifest that one day you and I will be enjoying a gorgeous ice cream cone at the tea dance in P-Town and gossiping and gagging up a storm.
We'll be talking about your hole, Eric. It'll be great.
And I will have it no other way. God bless.
God bless.
Thanks for listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast. If you enjoyed this interview with the delicious Brian Sims, tag us on Instagram at Gay Ass Podcast, or I'm at Eric Wills with a Z. And if you want more gay assery, there's a very, very good bonus episode up on Substack this week with gay ass producer Nathaniel, who not only had a recent birthday, but a recent birthday three-way that had him break his number one sex rule. Go to substack.com/@EricWills to watch that there and many other bonus episodes. And I hope you have an amazing rest of your gay ass week. As always, stay gay. Bye. You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed to us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or Patreon at Gay Ass Podcast. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.